Welcome, everyone, to the Watchmen podcast by Fantastic Geek, your official, unofficial podcast for Watchmen on HBO. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everybody. Digging in today to Chapter 1, At Midnight, All the Agents.
Pete, first bit of podcast news. Not exactly series news quite yet, but Pete, the brilliant plan. We know that when the series does come out, certainly it will be dense. Certainly it will require digestion. And thus, though it will be airing on HBO on Sunday nights, we're going to give a little time for us to get our thoughts together, for listeners to share their thoughts. So aim for our podcast, once the series comes out, to be coming out on Wednesdays. That's Watchmen Wednesdays.
Definitely going to require a visual fast prior to each helping, and probably going to go back a couple times to make sure that we can provide the type of analysis that this show is going to demand and that Fantastic Geek has come to promise.
Well, as you said, Pete, today we're talking Chapter 1 of the graphic novel. Its summary from the wiki at watchmen.fandom.com is as follows. Opening image, a smiley face lying on top of a pool of the comedian's blood. There's also a drop of blood on the face. Edward Blake is mysteriously thrown out of his apartment window and plummets to his death on the street. Rorschach investigates and finds that Edward Blake is in fact the comedian. Rorschach notifies Dan Dryberg, Night Owl 2, Adrian Veidt, Ozymandias, Dr. Manhattan, John Osterman, and Laurie Euspezic, Silk Spectre 2, of the hero's death. Laurie then meets Dan for drinks and reminiscing. The closing quotation is, "At midnight, all the agents and the superhuman crew go out and round up everyone who knows more than they do." That from Desolation Row by Bob Dylan. And the attached document at the end of this chapter are the first two chapters of Under the Hood by Hollis Mason. They describe why he decided to become the costumed hero Night Owl. Where should we start, Pete, in our analysis of Chapter 1?
I want to begin with the attached document because as I was teaching the graphic novel and the show coming to HBO was announced formally, the thing that maybe seemed the most Linda Lofian, the thing I was hoping to really get a taste of, given what Lindelof has done on HBO, what with Leftovers, and again with the flashback-heavy Lost. Matt has a little bit of experience podcasting that. Was this particular part about Hollis Mason as a child and the completely pathetic story, anecdote, really, about this mechanic who had been cheated on, his wife had cheated on him, and he's, you know, there with the fake foam breasts listening to Ride of the Valkyries. And it's just this mix of pathos and zaniness and just unlike anything I'd read at all, ever. I remember reading this for the first time. I had a really high fever, and the book only gets better and better and better, you know, when you're not on a fever. But I remember reading this and like, wow, I did not expect to read something like this.
Well, particularly when you figure on the initial publication, you know, one per month, roughly, this is, of course, where the letters would go. They didn't, you know, the letters to the editor kind of thing. Of course, there were none yet for the first issue. So, hey, it'll be several months before we can get letters in there. Let's fill it with kind of in-universe extensions. And then, of course, they stick with it for chapters 1 through 11 and then just go for four more pages of content in chapter 12. I can only imagine how jarring that must have been. You know, it's one thing when you say, oh, Watchmen, one of the, you know, top 100 books from 1923 to today, says Time Magazine, and, you know, this vaunted graphic novel. But it wasn't a graphic novel when you went to your local comic shop and picked up Watchmen number 1. It was the first edition in a thing that's going to be limited, and what's this all about? And if the preceding bunch of pages weren't clue enough that this is wildly different, all of a sudden now you have pages from a book, and there are photographs, albeit, you know, penciled by Dave Gibbons, but there are photographs in the book, and it's just this very different thing.
Yeah, and it just adds such a layered effect to the way that the story is told and the vantage point we get. And I think that a TV show on HBO is just going to lend itself to do this kind of supplemental work. And I'm really, really excited, you know, not just for the main narrative of the show, but how they can put this type of thing on top of it, as I expect they will.
It's also interesting, too, going back and rereading this chapter through the lens of the movie. And I, you know, I don't think we are alone, Pete, in not loving the movie, particularly some of the great Snyder-esque directorial flourishes, you know, to see that first page in the novel where, yes, you know, as it turns out, we have started from before the first page, this decision where the cover is super close up, and then in the first page we're zooming up, up, up from the button all the way to the penthouse. But I couldn't help but see that, you know, that button and be like, oh man, I know how many times in the first 5 minutes of the movie they make sure to get splatter on the button and show the button and show it in every, you know, possible angle and things of that sort. And it's just more restraint here in this, the master foundational text.
The film is such a mixed bag. I think the credit sequence is tremendously, tremendously done. It might be my favorite credit sequence of any film, just in the way they acknowledge all the little details, things that never come back up in the film at all. You know, Mothman being thrown into the back of, you know, an old timey ambulance to be taken to a mental hospital, and, you know, those types of details. But they really do nail the opening chapter, I feel. I mean, do they leave out, you know, the detectives doing their thing? They do, because, you know, who's the detective we're following in a narrative like that? We're following Rorschach and not this two-tiered detective story, you know, our hero slash anti-hero, and then, you know, the everyman who are trying to put it together for themselves. But they do a very, very good job of that in the film.
Generally, yes. I think it is interesting, though, and I don't mean to overly dump on Zack Snyder, but the one panel from this chapter that always sticks with me is that wider view of Dan in front of the Archimedes, and the way it's drawn by Dave Gibbons, you have just this extra sorrow in him. This is, you know, him looking less svelte than he will in later chapters, and there's just so much pathos there. And I know the movie tries to capture that, but it's a little bit different with, you know, movie ready Patrick Wilson versus just the sorrow that bleeds into that one panel. And I think that's typical of this entire chapter. It's really setting up a whole bunch of really disparate parts that, you know, for a first time reader, it's all over the place. And there's the grand, you know, grand reveal after grand reveal. Next thing you know, there's a giant naked blue man. And, you know, on the second, the fifth, the tenth, the 50th read, you can see all these pieces here, or you know what their origins already are. But it's like I can't go back to the first time I read this and not comprehending what was going on.
I really appreciate when Rorschach gets into the comedian's apartment and he finds the secret area of the closet, and, you know, you get to the top of a page and you're like, all right, I see the Captain America-esque star. I see, you know, weapons of war here. There's silencers, there's a knife, and what the heck is up with the Pulp Fiction gimp mask?
I mean, I think that that scene in particular is one where, again, there's this trust from Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. Pete, are we able to say Alan Moore's name even? We're podcasting the series. We're talking about the book now. Do we just set off Alan Moore? Is he now doing witchcraft to get us? I don't know. But, you know, so little dialogue when Rorschach first enters the apartment. And it kind of takes a minute to be like, okay, he takes the hanger apart. He's held it up to the wall. Like, it kind of takes a minute. We have to go back and go, oh, look, there's a little hitch there. Oh, wait, the lengths are different. Yeah. And then same thing as you say, once the closet opens, yes, there is that Captain America-esque feel to it. And I think that, as you suggested, Pete, what sells it as something different is going on here is kind of the severity of that mask.
And it's something that you don't go get Jeffrey Dean Morgan coming off of, Grey's Anatomy at his zenith as a television actor. Yes, Walking Dead and Negan and everything like that, but nowhere near the visibility and certainly on the way down on that show. You don't go out and get somebody like that and say, hey, we're going to put you in this creepy ball gag mask.
Pete, I don't know how to segue from that, but segue I will. I think too, for somebody to read this, to be reading this for the first time and to be looking at the color palette that John Higgins gives, obviously and certainly well known, this attempt to give a lot of the background colors, not primary colors, but secondary colors, kind of the purples, the pinks, the yellows, and it just adds this weird sickliness to it. I mean, if you look at that full nine panel page where it's Rorschach, checking out the closet there, the predominant color is yellow. I mean, he's in an empty apartment at night and the predominant color is yellow. There's something counterintuitive there, which I know that's what they were going for. And it just sells this weird sickliness to it.
Yeah, and, particularly as you move throughout this chapter, seeing in foreground and background and the way the color sets things off, we're seeing the knot tops with, creepy tattoos of swastikas and, partial headlines on newspaper honor boxes and things like this. And it sells so much of the atmosphere on top of, this strange kind of buddy dark comedy between Rorschach and Dan, the bean juice, the whole nine yards there, human bean juice, all of that.
Pete, from the highest highs, here's a question for you. A couple of pages into Dr. Manhattan's introduction there, I guess it would be page 22 as it's numbered there. I've always wondered this. Here we have a live knowledge happening right on the podcast here. At least in my copy, Dr. Manhattan's word bubbles are not blue on page 22. Is that the case for yours? And follow-up question, if it is there some sort of meta-commentary going on here about the value of his words, or is that just a printing error?
We have different pages, you and I.
Okay.
However, the word bubbles are blue at times, and I think this is done in a way to really suggest, as is played well in the movie, just this sense of calm. And that's why now that we've pulled back the curtain and we know definitively something I've known for a while, that Dr. Manhattan is going to appear in the show. I'm not going to tell you who plays him yet. And Matt doesn't know this at all. But I'm very interested in another performance after we had Billy Crudup play him in the only live action appearance.
It's interesting that you should say that the way Dr. Manhattan's word bubbles are presented in the novel, that suggested a calming voice. To me, it was the opposite. It kind of was this, this booming, resonant resonant, kind of almost energy-filled voice to him. And one of the things I think the movie was successful at was not having, you know, Billy Crudup with an echo, and instead to just have this detached warmth. Like, it's curious, you know, the way one watches with kind of pleasant curiosity, you know, a praying mantis on a flower, and he's like, oh, look, people doing things. Isn't that strange? Pete, somehow the terrible experience of the movie feels less terrible through the lens of our discussion here.
In this particular part of the book, in the presentation of it, yes. And do they hit everything? No. And they can't. And you understand that and you forgive it. For me, this chapter in particular, you know, effortless exposition, introducing all of our main characters. And then we get that texture that's just so, so important and rich and nuanced of all the other things going on. And then backstory, you know, we see a picture of the Minutemen that, you know, Blake evidently held onto. But we don't have all that yet. And I can only imagine what it was like. I mean, we were tykes back in the 80s when this was published. But what it must have been like, you know, you pick that first one up, and then a couple months later, you're getting the story of the Minutemen. You're getting, you know, more background there and how it would inform what you had read before.
It's interesting that you're highlighting how we get all our main players introduced here, even down to seeing the unmasked Walter, the unmasked Rorschach, carrying his "the end is nigh" sign. I think that on second read, you go, oh my goodness, how did I miss that bit of foreshadowing,
right?
That,
right,
that they say, you know, who could have done this or whatever it is. Then immediately in the next panel, you have his face and they feel a shiver as he walks by. But I think you have a page where there's purples and pinks and you still don't know what's going on, and there's the newness of the world. You're only four pages in. I think that most readers can be excused to not put, you know, Rorschach still out there somewhere, and your eyes literally move to the unmasked Rorschach. I think not making that connection is certainly excusable.
It's a novel. I don't like to just call it a graphic novel. I think it's so much more important than that. It is a novel I have read repeatedly and continue to pick things up. But I remember, you know, you get to that reveal later on that the redheaded guy is Rorschach, and you're going back. You're like, I've seen him before. I've seen him. And you're flipping back through, and it just rewards that.
And that's why we're still talking about this as a text, right? And this also forming the foundation of the series, not in production, but kind of in the, you know, this is the foundation from which X number of years later, the series is springing forth. It is that richness. It's the fact that Alan Moore can sit there and type out, you know, 1,000-word single space typed document describing how one page, one full panel page should look. You know, is all of that thought going to make its way into how it gets penciled? Maybe not, but you know what? It sure doesn't hurt. It sure doesn't hurt whether it's directly or whether it's inspiring your penciler, in this case, Dave Gibbons, or whatever it might be, to just really sell a level of depth to this world.
A text, Matt, more like a tome. This thing is dense. It is something to be studied, appreciated, cherished. All the more reason why we're so looking forward to the advancement of the story all these years later on HBO in a way that it can be told.
Absolutely. And of course, still no date outside of October. I guess, you know, place your bets. Is it October 6th, 13th, 20th, or 27th? One of those, all but certainly the case. And can't wait to share that news when we do get a final date, a formal date. Can't wait to share that with listeners. But certainly plenty of road there, Pete, from then till now.
Absolutely. And as soon as we know, we will be talking to you about it. Again, the situation there, they'll air on Sunday nights. We might even, you know, give you a hot take if it's not on the mics. Definitely over Twitter. but Watchmen Wednesdays when our podcasts will drop.
In the interim, Pete, are there any other dense, lengthy comic book-based properties that maybe could tie into this a little bit?
Absolutely. Well, you're listening to Fantastic Geek, and we are the official, unofficial voice of the Marvel Cinematic community. We do every show in the MCU, whether it's the flagship, your Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., whether it is the only two current shows still on, Matt, now that Marvel Netflix and Inhumans and Agent Carter have gone the way of the dodo. So we also have your Runaways, which will be the next one up, season three, coming to Hulu in December. And then your Cloak and Dagger, although we technically don't know if they've been renewed yet, even though they're going to show up on season three, one episode of Runaways. But we bring you every Marvel Cinematic Universe movie as well. You can listen to them over on the Marvel Movie Podcast by Fantastic Geek. So we are raffling away to you an Avengers Endgame digital download code. We're going to be giving that away, drawing that 10 days from now. That's going to be on Friday, August 23rd. We'll be notifying the winner. So how do you get entries? A couple different ways. You can write a review on Apple Podcasts and give us notice. Hey, you know, my name is Dr. Manhattan, 1986, and I'm really John Osterman, so we can pick it for you. But then again, you know if you've already won or haven't won. You can share our statuses on Facebook. That's going to get you additional entries. You can retweet us, follow us on Twitter. And Matt, if you are a patron on Patreon.com, you will get double entries for any of those actions that you do.
So whether that's existing patrons or new patrons, you're already in the running times two. Pete, yes. That's a pretty sweet deal there.
It is for the all-time international box office champion.
Indeed, Pete. And all of this, of course, made possible by the people who do support us on patreon.com/fantasticgeek. So our thanks to them as they help us out with storage and bandwidth costs and all that behind the scenes bleepity bloop stuff that, you know, that we generally don't need to talk about because it's all stored away at our secret snow-filled lair with the weird genetically engineered cat thing.
Yes, and you get in with just a dollar. So all it takes is a dollar. You're going to get those double entries on this giveaway. And who knows, maybe you come away the winner.
Pete, how can people be in touch with you to talk about Watchmen, the graphic novel, Watchmen, the movie, Watchmen, the vaunted, hopefully, HBO series, which we are so excited about?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, PIETERJKETELAR, KETELAAR, 10,604 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast. Comment on FantasticGeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Gmail, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with the PH, all one word, like it today.
Well, Pete, we will be back soon to talk Chapter 2 of the Watchmen graphic novel, and certainly can't wait to dive on into that. Until then, Pete, I will say human bean juice to all our listeners and give you the final word.
The comedian is dead.